I think, that we met in the Scarred Lands. The rats were forcing him to work for them. He's the one who pointed them toward Chirul. Smart kid. Brave, too. He's the reason that Pratt lost his stone in a river. But he had this talent for working with enneagrams that was intriguing. I've never even heard about something like it before. After our experiments this summer, we want to see about recruiting him. After we rescue him, Tyndall conceded. It's a little early in your careers to take on apprentices of your own, isn't it? Asked Festaren. We wouldn't teach him, Tyndall snorted. We've got things to do. But he needs evaluation, Rondal continued. We just want to find him and let a responsible party determine the nature and extent of his regira. But mostly we want to poke the Brotherhood with something as pointy and nasty as one of those rat tails of theirs, Tyndall finished. We owe them for, well, a couple of things. And what better way to start our careers as free gentlemen knights magi than a blood vendetta with a powerful and sinister criminal organization? Despite their joviality, I could tell both of them were feeling depressed at the thought of leaving Sevendor, even if it was to pursue their own interests. They would always have a home there, I told them when I had deposited them, speechless, in front of Harterian's office at Wilderhall. But they needed the freedom and the space to be able to make a place for themselves in the world. I could just give it to them, of course. It would be easy enough to grant them each an estate, or even a domain. But they were young men of action. They didn't need real estate right now. They needed experience. We will be staying for the opening of the Kasari Rites, though, Rondal mentioned. We have some friends who will be awarded their raptor ranks after their quest. No, we couldn't miss the idol dedication, agreed Tyndall. We worked too hard to find that thing and harder to get it out of there. I want to see it put where everyone can see the ugly thing. What was it exactly? I asked, curious. It's supposed to be quite old. A man-sized bronze anthropomorphic ursine, Rondal said, after a moment's consideration. Wearing a hat. And trousers, added Tyndall. The Kasari are weird. Lemsiddens was unlike any other town in the Wilderlands. For one thing, it was ancient, older than the Majocracy, it was said. Considering what Penny had discovered about the Kasari's origin, that was a lot more believable than it had once been. About 4,000 Kasari lived there in an unwalled settlement at the top of a broad foothill. The cliffs of the Colleens spread out to the north and west behind it. A long, narrow lake curled around the base of the hill to the east and south. The broad high street that ran north through the center of the town was sectioned off with smaller streets at perfect right angles. The market square was wide and well-planned, well-cobbled and spacious. There was no specific fortification evident, but the walls of the homes and shops seemed thick and strong, made of dressed stone and thick, well-cured oak logs, stacked horizontally on each other, as sturdy as a palisade. That was a big difference from the post-and-beam, wattle-and-daub construction even the well-to-do Castali Wilderlords boasted. The Kasari elders of the Filmon Council had assembled to greet us in Lemsittens. Almost twice as large as the Bransea Council, the leaders stood at solemn attention as the trackmaster brought the column to a halt in front of them, displaying all of the troop banners at the front of the line. There was a little ceremony as the council officially accepted all of the candidates for the various rites, and even a few jokes as the elders mentioned repeatedly the 8,000 additional children they hadn't planned on receiving. Then the troops were dismissed, and the crowded square erupted in triumphant shouts. The march was over. The quest was done. I felt profoundly weary and deeply satisfied at the same time. It was time to say some goodbyes after I met with the council elders. I saluted and dismissed my patrol and my troop for the final time. Arborn pounded me on the back and called me a brother. Pentandra hugged me just as tightly, before withdrawing with Arborn to submit her name for the autumn rites. Rael, Lalwyn, Ormar, and Landric, and every ranger there, insisted on shaking my hand and thanking me. Brother Hotfoot found me, after turning over the rolls of the march to the Kasari, and thanked me, knowingly. He also blessed Trailblazer, which I appreciated. The staff was one of his sacred symbols. Then Alia hugged me and cried, and then everyone else wanted to hug me. I was solemnly saluted so many times it got confusing. While dozens wanted to thank me for what I'd done, at that moment I felt I hadn't done much at all. They had. They had eluded danger and built 7 sturdy little castles, all in one summer. They had braved danger and courted death. They had bravely dared to go into a hostile wilderness and emerge stronger, smarter, and better than they had set out. One moment I recall seeing Brother Hotfoot smiling joyfully and cheering. He caught my eye and gave me a knowing nod. The next time I turned around, he was gone, though no one recalls seeing him leave. I would have to get used to that, as I had with Brigger. That night there was a grand feast, Kasari style. Gareth's kitchen at Timberwatch had prepared one last service, using the last of their stores and specially ordered delicacies before getting paid and moving on. The Filmon Council had gone to great lengths to prepare dozens of roasts in fire pits surrounding the town, and the hunters had brought back plenty of deer, moose, bison, and other game to cook. Everyone got plenty to eat that night, before the great campfires that lit the camp. Tomorrow the children would begin the rites. According to the agreement that we had carefully hammered out with the elders, the 2,000 original Kasari would conduct their rites first, while the pilgrim children were organized into more remedial camps. Then would begin the process of spreading them throughout Kasar, some into camps that hadn't been used for centuries. Feeding them would get expensive. 8,000 extra mouths were more than Kasar could comfortably absorb. There was still a little gold rattling around from the march, and Prince Tavard's generous donation had been more than enough to cover the hike through Castal. The remainder would go into a fund to import grain and other food into Kasar to feed them, until I could come up with a more permanent solution. That was a big change for Kasar, which had always prided itself on its self-sufficiency and isolation. But the elders also recognized the opportunity at hand. Not only would they get thousands of fresh adherents to the Kasari way, they would also be gaining a powerful political ally, something they had never had in their affairs with the Narasi. Their economy was not built on agriculture as much as horticulture and hunting. But you can't feed 8,000 extra kids on squirrels and nuts. They would adapt, for now, and become more involved in the wider world outside of their groves. Not all the kids would be staying, either. A long line of them stretched in front of the tent that had been erected by the square, where the old nun, who had been blessed by Brigger, dispensed her divine insight into the talents and passions of the children who presented themselves. Some she counseled to pursue a career at arms, and so the orphans' band gained a few hundred new young recruits. A few hundred more were encouraged to take holy orders in one temple or another, and so were returning with the sisters of Brigger back to Wilderhall to be called to service at the many temples there. Some were counseled to pursue a particular trade, and so a few dozen were returning to the summer capital to search for craft masters, to consider them as apprentices. But many others were given no solid advice on a career or a vocation. Instead, the nun's words pushed the child to pursue a passion, like poetry or sport, or seek a life on the road somehow. And to others, her words were even more mysterious and intriguing. Not all shared what was said in the tent with their friends, and some came out wide-eyed or tearful, but none left it unmoved. "Do you want to speak to the priestess?" asked a pretty young, scarlet-robed Novit of Brigger. She was managing the line when some of us came by to investigate the miracle I'd arranged. "I've been instructed to offer you the privilege of an immediate audience," she smiled. "That might not be a bad idea for you two," Pentandro pointed out to Tyndall and Rondal. "If you're going to ride off on your own, you had best know what direction would be prudent." When the next child emerged, the priestess ushered Tyndall in. He wasn't gone long. He came out a few moments later with a silly grin on his face. Rondal, on the other hand, exited the tent looking thoughtful and a little shaken. "Will you speak to her, my lord?" she asked Duke Anguin, without realizing who he was. The lad chuckled and strode confidently inside. He was there longer than the others, but when he came out, he looked neither amused nor thoughtful. He looked determined. Frightfully determined. Pentandro went in and came out weeping, before collapsing in Arborn's arms. Arborn went a few moments later and emerged smiling broadly. "Sir Festaren, Dara, Ormar, Landric, each of my faithful war magi took their turn hearing their reed read. Then it was Alia's turn. She took perhaps 5 minutes, and then came out from the flap with an expression that was a mixture of serene joy, fear, and amusement. Then it was my turn. I felt a little smug as I slipped past the sturdy hemp-cloth door, a faint smell of mildew clinging to it. Inside there was a portly woman of late middle age, a habit covering her hair, dressed in a more comfortable version of the orange and red robes of the senior sisters of Brigga.
"So, you're the spellmonger?"
she grunted, sipping ale from a mug.
"I've heard about you. Some say it was at your behest that Brigga gave me this blessing."
"I may have had something to do with it," I shrugged.
"I got struck by bloody lightning thanks to you, and it's been a bloody pain in my arse ever since,"
she accused angrily.
"There I was, ready to settle into a quiet retirement with a good man, and suddenly I can't close my eyes without seeing what a man can do best. Completely ruined my plans,"
she spat, irritated. "But the coin you could earn," I suggested half-heartedly.
"How I could earn a nice bit, if I wanted to go back to the bloody temple. Already have, if you want to know the truth. That Duke fellow himself gave me gold,"
she said, showing me a purse.
"But what use is that to me? We've got our pleasant little cot, no taxes to speak of, a few goats and a cow. What do we need money for? In Kassar? Bloody bother is all this is."
Sorry? I offered. I thought priestesses wanted to be touched by their deities.
"Maybe some young idiots," she snorted. "But the world works best when the gods stay put and let us do our jobs. But what's done is done. And now I have to paint a smile on my face and tell all of these kiddies what they should be when they grow up, including you. So, step up in the light, spellmonger," she said, peering at me. "And let's see the face of the man who made me miserable and made all of these children so happy." "Don't worry about it," I dismissed as she took my hands in her chubby fingers. "I already know what my passion is. Magic. And I've already risen as high as a man might, so I doubt that you'll tell me much of use." "Do you now?" she cackled. "Yet you have not achieved all you might,"
she pointed out, after closing her eyes for a few moments. "I'm the highest-ranking mage in the kingdom," I protested. "Oh, perhaps not," I conceded. "I suppose I could eventually get appointed to a higher position."
"Indeed,"
she said evenly, regarding me steadily.
"Most who speak to me lead me to speak in only the vaguest possibilities. But you, Minolan the spellmonger, your fate is so entwined with so many others. A simple answer would be worse than none at all. Your talents, your intelligence and your wisdom are such that you will be called to serve your vocation at the pinnacle of its calling. You are destined for greatness," she shrugged.
"I suppose it is inevitable," I grumbled, considering the inconvenience of moving to the royal court. "Eventually Hartarion will retire. Rad won't be able to convince anyone else to do it, and I'll get drafted again."
"I can see more of you than most men,"
she admitted, her hands clinging to mine, her eyes dazed.
"Your path will include several realms,"
she continued, in a somewhat wavering voice.
"The gods, the tree folk, and powers darker than I can stomach to see will all strive to compel your attention. Our very ancestors will speak to you from their graves, and you will hunt down the legend of the Forsaken. But regardless of the path you take, your destination is the same. You are destined for higher position," she said.
"That is dangerously close to prophecy," I said uncomfortably. "And you don't need to be a prophet to tell that I'll likely be chosen by Rad to be next royal court wizard."
"Court wizard?"
the old nun snorted, amused.
"Nay, spellmonger, for you I foresee a higher position still. For you, your talents and your passions, your insights and your wisdom, your follies and your mistakes, all lead down the same road to the same destination. You, Minalan the spellmonger, she pronounced, are destined to become the Archmage.
You have been listening to Journey Mage, Book 6 of the Spellmonger series, produced by Greg Lawrence, Associate Producer Emily Durr. Text copyright 2018 by Terry Mancor. Production copyright 2018 by Podium Publishing. All rights reserved. If you enjoyed this audiobook, find more just like it by visiting audfans.com, the premier audiobook discovery service that brings tailored recommendations direct to your email. That's audfans.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.